1 Corinthians 12 and 14 are notorious battleground chapters for those who engage in the debate regarding tongues and some of the so-called miraculous and sign gifts. And so as I was surveying this book in anticipation of preaching through it, I assumed that when we got to those chapters, we would just roll up our sleeves and work through them and deal with those issues as they presented themselves. Since I had not preached through 1 Corinthians before in this fashion, I had, before this series began, basically looked at this book as a topical index resource for church problems. Is there a problem with people who are cliquish and spiritually immature? Oh, chapter 3. Chapter 3 has some really good stuff on there. Are there people in the church who are proud and who are acting as if the leaders of the church just don't get it? Well, chapter 4 is a good resource for handling that. What do you do when there's sexual immorality in the church? Well, go to chapter 5. Paul deals with it there. Should I ever sue another Christian brother or sister in a court of law? Hey, that's a good question. Check out chapter 6. Do you have questions about marriage, intimacy, divorce, singleness, remarriage? Chapter 7 is the place for you. And if you have people who are debating about lifestyle decisions and whether or not these things are really wrong or sometimes wrong, or chapters 8 and 9 are very helpful for that. And you have rich people who don't want to associate with poor people. And you have people in the church dividing themselves up over preferences. Well, boy, chapter 11 has much that you need to consider. And in that view, I saw the entire book. Here was your catalog. If you had a question about a topic, check it out. Want to deal with tongues and prophecy? Okay. Chapters 12 and 14 are for you. And I basically viewed chapter 13 as this great little chapter of love stuck in between these battleground chapters of 12 and 14. But that is not how the Apostle Paul wrote this book. On the surface, yes, we see the topics. But this book began with the gospel. And what I mean by that is that Paul established at the very beginning that there is no way that you can deal with the problems of life, the problems of family life, the problems of church life, without understanding the message of the cross and applying the implications of it to every situation. We are called to be people who smell like the cross. And we do that by living in a manner that is consistent with its message. And so, brothers and sisters, that is the theme of this book. That like a river, it flows through every single chapter. And it waters and nourishes every single verse. And when we start to understand what happened at the cross and what motivated the Father to send Christ to the cross and what motivated Christ to die, then we are closer to understanding the message of this book. And all that Paul is doing here in chapter 13 is opening up in front of us the heart, the very heart of Christ. And he's contrasting that with how we tend to live. If the believers at Corinth had really grasped the implications of the gospel for everyday life, then chapter 13 would not be so radical. Chapter 13 to us, it just seems so. Are you kidding me? Can anybody live like this? that truthfully, if the believers at Corinth were living as if this chapter, as this chapter calls them to, their church wouldn't be in such a stinking mess. But it's not just them, is it? And what we thought was going to be this nice little oasis, this nice little chapter, this little poem on love in the midst of the controversial gift issue, has turned out to be a seriously convicting study of our own hearts. As the weeks have rolled on, I have come to expect a high level of conviction in my study. And I have felt as I go into my study, almost putting on a helmet and pads, because I know that this text is going to go after me. But I need it. At least in chapters 12 and 14, I can get involved in a little bit more of the debate arena, where, as you know, I don't mind treading in from time to time. But in chapter 13, it's just plain convicting. And that, truthfully, is welcome. And it is needed. And it is refreshing. And it is joyful because of the gospel. I remind you of how this chapter breaks down. Verses 1, 2, and 3, Paul is dealing with the priority of love. In verses 4, 5, 6, and 7, he's describing love, the properties of love. And when we eventually get there, verses 8 through 13, the permanence of love. We are now looking at the properties of love, discovering more and more that love is a commitment and an uncompromising devotion rooted in the very character of God Himself. To give of yourself for the benefit of another, even if that person does not deserve it, cannot ever give back to you, and even if no one else will ever know. And we see love here in chapter 13, verses 4 through 7, described in terms of what it isn't and what it is. And today we're looking at three of the things that it is not. I'm in verse number 5. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. These three sinful actions, self-seeking, being easily angered, keeping a record of wrongs, are actions that are part of a life that is driven by its own sense of justice. This is an easy position to take. If I don't take care of myself, well, who will? I have to look out for what is good for me. And if you mess with me, or with you, the people in my world that I care about, then you know what I'm doing. I'm putting you on my list. Now that I have my list and I know who's on my list, I'll be a bit more prepared to protect myself. Because if I see you coming, oh yeah, you're on my list. Oh, I saw that look. That's going on my list too. And that is a great recipe for bitterness. Because what do we do with that list? We read it. And we keep reading it. Behind every sin is a promise. Behind every sin is a promise. Bitterness is no exception. Bitterness promises you the satisfaction of revenge. If you can exact pain upon your perceived enemy, then you will be vindicated, you will be satisfied and happy. But the problem is you can't handle bitterness. Bitterness will betray you. It will make you think that if you retain the authority to be judge and jury and executioner, then you will be happy. But all along you are setting and facilitating the demise of your own life. Instead of exacting pain upon others, bitterness just sucks the joy right out of your life. You think you are hurting others, and perhaps to some degree you are, but not to the level that you destroy yourself. Most of you are aware that it was Judas Iscariot who betrayed Christ and was paid off 30 pieces of silver in exchange for leading a group of soldiers to the place where they could arrest Christ. We find out that in John's Gospel, chapter 12, verses 4 through 6, that it was Judas who resented the fact that Mary had, quote unquote, wasted an expensive bottle of perfume on Christ by pouring it on his feet. And Judas sounded real pious when he declared how this should have been sold and the money given to feed the poor. And when Jesus confronted Judas that day and any of the other disciples who had agreed with him, we find out that in Matthew's account of this story, in chapter 26, verses 6 through 16, that immediately following this, that's when Judas went and secretly arranged to betray Christ. Judas, it appears, was embarrassed. He was angry. And he found a way to get even. Did he cause pain? Absolutely. But what was the cost? In attempting to destroy Christ, he destroyed himself. And the heart of chapter 13 is not about secrets on how to get along better with others or how to be thought of as a really nice person. The truth of this chapter is absolutely impossible to grasp, much less live, unless one has a completely different heart. Because a person who is without Christ lives for self. He or she is born that way. We all are. We are pre-programmed. We are hardwired that way. And the end of that way is death. But the person who has been born into the family of God, who has had the love of God poured into his heart, that there is now a new center. That's what Paul's referring to in Romans 5:5. And he says, God has poured out his love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, whom he has given us. And this is one of the results of becoming a follower of Christ. This new center, this new person that you now become, now has the capacity to love on a completely different level. And instead of loving others as a means to loving ourselves, we are now free to be able to give of ourselves to the benefit of others, even if they cannot ever give back to us, and even if they don't deserve it or no one else will ever know. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not self-seeking. And because it is not self-seeking, it's not easily angered. And because it's not self-seeking, it doesn't keep a record of wrongs. First thing I want you to see, love is not self-seeking. Love is not preoccupied with the interests of self. At the very least, this means that love does not parade its gifts or accomplishments, does not have to wear on its sleeve all the things that it has done. Because a person who is not preoccupied with self is free from trying to impress you. He's not ashamed of it. He will make it known if it will benefit others, but he or she just doesn't have to rub your face in it. This kind of love, love that is not self-seeking, is in such a stark contrast to our world's understanding of love. Eros type of love. We hear it over and over. It seems like it is on the news every week. A guy and a girl are in a relationship. Apparently, she initially likes the attention. In reality, he wants control. He wants total control. And of course, it's not always the guy. Sometimes it's the girl. She tries to break it off and he threatens to do something crazy. Like hurt her. Or hurt others. Or hurt himself. If you don't do what I want, I'm going to hurt you. Or I'm going to take my own life and everybody will know it was your fault. That's Eros. Eros turns people into things. It turns lives into possessions. It turns friendship into power plays. This particular point has so many applications in marriage, in potential marriage, in families, in friendship relationships, in the church. The true love, as God defines it, it is not the desire to gain mastery over another person and use that for your own purposes. In fact, true love is not preoccupied with the interests of self. But does that mean that we as believers never stand up for what is right if, for example, our rights have been violated? What if, for example, you own a business and your business agrees to make $10,000 worth of products for a customer? And you do that and you ship that product to the customer and the customer fails to pay his bill. What do you do? If you are a Christian, are you supposed to say, well, love isn't self-seeking? And therefore, I ought to take the high road and not seek payment. Shouldn't you be willing to take the loss rather than go through the messy process of even involving the courts if need be? Is that what this is talking about? Because if so, that means that love and justice are now at odds with each other. That is not what this is saying. If you do not get paid for your product, you cannot pay your supplier. If you don't get paid for your product, you can't pay your workers. And not paying your supplier and not paying your workers is not loving, is it? You see, love does not trample justice. In fact, pursuing payment is, in this case, driven by pursuing justice, which is a loving thing for your suppliers and your workers. Now, there are certainly times when love is willing to set its own rights aside unless that results in the injustice for others. We often quote in our service Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 10, which speaks of the humiliation and the subsequent exaltation of Christ. And that particular passage, which is part of the whole flow there in the book of Philippians, is part of a section where Paul is setting forth different examples of people who have loved others to such an extent that they have set aside their own comforts for the benefit of others. And you see that. There's an illustration there of Epaphroditus and Timothy and ultimately of Paul himself, because all of that is flowing to chapter 4 where Paul is saying to Syntyche and Euodia, two women in the church who weren't getting along, he was saying, you know what? You guys can take this to your grave if you stand there and both demand your rights, or you can look at Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, who humbled himself. That's the pattern. And so Paul starts at the top What rights did Christ have? And the answer is, He had ultimate rights. He was God, for crying out loud. And even though He had those rights, how did He use them? He set His rights aside in order for justice to be accomplished. We'll look at that a little bit more this evening. Because Christ was not held to that cross by nails. You can't put God on a cross and keep Him there with nails. His love for you put Him there. His love for the justice and the honor of His Father put Him there. His love for the grace of God to be set on display put Him there. And He set aside His rights as God to become a servant and die. So I ask you, what rights do you have that you think are being neglected? What rights have been trampled? And do you have to have your perceived rights in order for you to be at peace? And your heart cries out, "You don't know how I've been hurt." Then you're right. And we could all stand here and talk about how we have been hurt and try to figure out some way to gauge whose hurt is worse than others, which is impossible. But every hurt that you have, as deep as it is, cannot begin to compare to the injustice and the hurt of Christ. Do you have to have your perceived rights restored in order for you to be at peace? The gospel is so helpful, brothers and sisters, because it reminds us over and over that anything this side of hell is grace. So when I ask you, how are you doing? The answer is, better than I deserve. Did you say that this week? I did at the bank. The teller didn't know if she could trust me with the money I was asking for. It is such a great response. Because it's so true. Love is not self-seeking. What would the church at Corinth look like if this one truth had been part of their relationships with each other? Well, the issue of what foods to eat, it wouldn't be an issue at all. The wealthy wouldn't be eating before the poor. That whole concept of, let's hurry up and eat before they get here, that wouldn't even be considered. The issue of interrupting speakers because of a supposed instant revelation, meaning that what the speaker had to say was not nearly as important as what the other person wanted to say, that would not be taking place at all. And the issue of someone in the church going on and on and on and on and on in an unknown tongue when there's no one who could interpret and therefore no one who could receive any benefit at all from what was being said, that wouldn't be a problem at all because you wouldn't even consider doing that. Love is not self-seeking. And because of that, number two, love is not easily angered. How many times did Christ respond to the thick skulls and hard hearts around Him and say, "I've had it! I quit! You guys are hopeless! You'll never get it!" Love is not exasperated. That is what this means. Exasperation is always a sign of defeat. Barclay said that. William, not Charles. Love does not become exasperated into blowing a gasket. Because the absence of self-interest keeps the pressure from building up that high. This year, the NBA has instituted a new rule that seeks to govern the responses of the players and coaches to calls made by the officials. I may be one of the very few who actually thinks it is a wonderful rule. And I recognize that there are inherent problems when you try telling a guy who's making $10 to $12 million a year that he can't always have his own way. That's the challenge. How do you respond when you are accused of committing a foul and you never touch the person? It ain't easy. Love is not exasperated. When you blow up at a person, even if you think you are justified, you lost it. Rudyard Kipling touched on this in his famous poem about being a man when he said, if you can keep your head while all others are losing theirs, and when hated, not give in to hate. Love does not pet. It hurts. Love does not review over and over the injustices that were committed against it, because when you do that and you read them over and over and over, then you get attitude. And when you convince yourself that people really owe you something, you are well on your way to being easily angered. In fact, the ride is really short. And for some people, it doesn't take much at all to get them going. They are an attitude looking for a cause. You know what I mean? And there is a series of landmines that rest under a very thin layer of skin in certain people. And you barely brush against them. Boom! They go off! But this person is the exact opposite of that. This is the person who never complains. You can't get them wound up if you try. That's the idea of this phrase. And by the way, hair trigger tempers and intimidating attitudes are a very effective means of keeping people at a distance, aren't they? Because if you live with attitude, you are doing that because you don't want people near you. There is something inside of you that you are afraid they are going to discover, and you don't think you can handle it if they find out what that is. And so you put on this attitude and you are a monster, and everybody keeps their distance and you think you're protected. But I want to ask you something. What are you afraid of? What is the truth about yourself that you dare not let out? And what is it that you think that the cross of Christ cannot resolve? At the very least, this love is not easily angered. It has to do with being touchy. Do people walk on eggshells around you? Or do you make yourself vulnerable to suggestions? Do you make it easy for people to point things out so that you can improve on them? But how do you do it? I mean, this is the ideal. How do you? And I think that the way you do it, is the key to that is found in this third thing. Love keeps no record of wrongs. In this statement here, in verse 5, the end of verse 5, it keeps no record of wrongs. The operative word that Paul originally used in this phrase is the word that means to reckon or consider. It is an accounting term. I go back to a list. Some of you have ledgers, don't you? You have a list of wrongs that other people have done to you. And from time to time, you read it over and remind yourself, oh yeah, I almost forgot that's what they've done. No, that's right, I am supposed to hate them. Okay, glad I thought of that. I mean, for a moment, I was almost nice. Can't let that happen. And you read it over and over and you remind yourself, that's why I'm better than them. Yes. Good. Okay. I kind of knew it all along. I just kind of forgotten what the real reason was. And you just go back and you relive the moment. And, oh yeah, I remember what I felt when they said that to me. Oh yeah, I remember. Oh yeah, that knife in the back. And so now your coldness is justified. And in your attempt to condemn others, you try to exonerate yourself. If it is now okay if you are mean. It's okay to be withdrawn. It's okay to be unmoved. It's okay to be unfeeling, uncaring for them. After all, they deserve it. It says so right on your list. Why do you keep that list? Well, someone has to. I mean, you can't let people get away with everything. So what happens? If you keep petting your hurts, nursing your wounds, reading your list, you keep them warm. Keep them massaged. You keep the blood flowing in them. They're fresh. They still smell. I'm told in one of the Polynesian island cultures, people used to keep reminders in their homes of past wrongs. When someone hurt them, they would hang an artifact in their hut, usually from the roof, as a reminder of this past offense. And every time they would go in, they would be able to rehearse them. And for some of you, what is even worse is that there are things on your list that never happened. You imagined them. You relied on hearsay. You misinterpreted them. You listened to gossip that itself was a lie, but you never resolved it in the right way. And so you've added things on your list that never, ever happened. And you have been treating some people in a sinful way, and they're absolutely clueless. Now, some of you have things on your list of what people have done to you. And brothers and sisters, that is part of life. We are sinners who sin against others, and we ourselves are the recipients of the sins of others. And the question is not, will you ever be hurt? The issue is, what are you going to do about it? If there is a legitimate issue, go to the other person. Go humbly. Ask questions. If the other person does not want to resolve it, and they're part of the body of believers, then you take two or three with you, humbly, in order to resolve it. If they're not a follower of Jesus Christ, that is as far as you can basically go with it. You have done what you can. Live at peace with God, knowing you've done that. There are some things that are beyond your control. So I ask you, what are you going to do with your list? Because you have a choice. You can either take your list to the cross, or you can hold on to this list. And you can put your hope and your security in this list. And in so doing, it'll rot your heart. And here's the betrayal of bitterness. If you hold on to these offenses in order to hurt the other person, you will tear yourself apart and turn your heart into stone. Love does not keep score. Only Christ, in the ultimate sense, has the right to keep score. And He set that right aside when He died. And if we are genuine followers of Him, can we honestly do any less? Will you stand with me? Will you bow your heads with me? And before God, will you try to answer this question? What are you going to do with your list? What are you going to do with your list? Father, it seems so normal for us to create this scenario of life, especially since we are so accustomed to being treated this way, that we so easily treat others just like that. I guess any of us can be nice to someone nice to us. But the grace to forgive, the desire to forgive, the hope, the longing to forgive, even when we continue to be wronged, God, we can't do that. Not in our strength. We need you for that. And when you help us become like that, then I think we will know a little more of Calvary's love. In Jesus' name we pray.